All right, here we go. Quiet!
Quiet! Quiet!
Roll up!
Hello and welcome to the Big Picture Podcast, where we take a look at the latest movie news, the films of yesterday and today, and put it all into some sort of context. Seated across the microphone from me is Film Buff Online contributing writer Natasha Bogitsky.
And seated across the microphone from me is Film Buff Online editor-in-chief Rich Dries. So, Rich, what's going on in the world of news this week?
Oh, so much. Actually, no. Not a whole lot of big film news this week. Just rolling out of the Oscars from last week. It always seems like that's a quiet week, which is kind of nice. Lets us relax and regroup and re-energize after the craziness of Oscar night. I mean, you know, we were covering it live for the site, as well as prepping to do that podcast immediately afterwards. And feel free to go back and listen to that if you didn't catch all our post-Oscars hot takes. There's a couple of things, and the first one that I wanted to talk about, actually, it's movie-related in the fact that Jon Favreau has just been picked to head up as the executive producer and showrunner a Star Wars television series that will appear on Disney's streaming service probably late 2019, 2020, but when that launches. Obviously, it's an expansion of the Star Wars universe. It's the first live-action television series. We've already had one live-action television special that everybody wants to forget about from years and years and years ago. And so far, Lucasfilm has done pretty well with both their animated series, Clone Wars, and then Rebels, which actually also just wrapped up this week. So, Natasha, are you ready for weekly doses of new Star Wars action and excitement?
Well, I was not a big fan of the animated series, Clone Wars, or Rebels, for that matter.
Really?
Really.
Why so?
I don't know. It just never caught my attention. It never struck me in a way of saying, you should probably sit down and watch this, even if it is, if it's directly connected or if it's an expansion of the Star Wars universe or galaxy. It never did it for me. But this, it's Jon Favreau. And there are very few things that he has done that I am not the biggest fan of. I loved him. And don't kill me for this. I am a woman and I do watch sitcoms, but I loved him in Friends.
Swingers. He was good there. He was fun. I'm going to cut you off right there because I made the joke as soon as this was announced. I made the joke that I just want to see this as Swingers in space.
Didn't someone else make a mention about Canto Bite?
Yeah. Canto Bite, baby. You are so credit. And just the fact that, you know, they take separate spaceships everywhere they go. Everybody gets in their own spaceship rather than all get into one and they all go there. I think that would be a lot of fun to see. And I'm sure that's exactly not the direction Lucasfilm is going with this.
Oh, shame.
I know. But anyways, other things about Jon Favreau you like?
Iron Man. Happy.
Oh, he's fantastic.
His live action Jungle Book was brilliant.
Far better than I expected it to be. I only have like one major problem with that, and that's more of a script level thing, and that's it's a straight adventure movie and then suddenly it breaks into a musical about halfway through. And I was like, if this is going to be a musical, we should have had songs before this.
Well, they did set up the music in the beginning and
a
they
little
opened
bit
it up. They opened it up just like the animated Jungle Book. I almost said traditional animated Jungle Book with the music going through that they were going to use later on in the film. And there weren't a lot of songs, though, in the animated Jungle Book film.
True.
I think there was maybe four, and the only one they cut for the live action was the elephants.
I think, you know, in my memory of Favreau's Jungle Book is a little dim because it's been a while since I've watched it. I think I saw it when it came out, and that was it. Didn't they turn Ka's Trust in Me from a song more into a spoken word almost thing, just a regular hypnotic thing, not an actual song?
A bit, but that works.
Okay.
Because in the animated version, it's for kids. You're playing up the fun hypnosis of the time period. You're dropping acid.
Not the biggest acid trip Disney has ever committed to animation. That will always be Winnie the Pooh and the Blustery Day.
Hey,
I love it. I think it's fun. It's great.
Heffalumps and Woozles is
and
the biggest
kids
acid
drinking too much Robitussin. I don't know.
When they did it in live action, they had to invoke more fear. Or otherwise, people are going to go, okay, this snake is trying to eat this kid, but I feel nothing at this point.
True. And that's a weird dichotomy because, you know, you're using CGI to make things more realistic. So you kind of have to walk a tightrope between that photorealism and the fact that you've got Bill Murray voicing a bear that's just bouncing along and singing songs. Which, and, you know, if you're going to substitute the late, great Phil Harris in the role of Baloo.
I wouldn't have picked anyone better.
Yeah, you couldn't. Bill Murray. Boom. Thank you. Good night. You know, we're done. We're done here. That was the shortest casting session in Hollywood.
Honest to God, when they were saying they were going to do live action Jungle Book, mm-hmm. that was the first person to pop into my head for Baloo.
Really? Okay. Yeah. I think part of me was just like, I don't know about this. And it turned out pretty good. You know, so well that he's actually in post-production right now on that live-action Lion King. And again, I have a question about that because there's no human characters in that. So is it all just photorealistic CG and motion capture performances, I guess?
Might be.
Yeah, I'm sure he'll turn in a fantastic film. You know, I'm very excited to see the results, but it seems like an odd choice to do it that way. Anyways, circling back to Star Wars, though, I'll say that the animated stuff that producer Dave Filoni has done so far with Clone Wars and Rebels, you know, firmly exists in the Star Wars universe. Is it essential to watch? No. When you see the ship that the heroes and rebels have appear at the Battle of Scarif in Rogue One, do you need to know that that ship is from Rebels? Not really. It's just, oh, there's another ship in the battle. But but that, you know, allows a nice little bit of interconnectedness between the two things. And quite honestly, I really liked Clone Wars for the most part. I thought there was a few wishy-washy episodes here and there. I liked Rebels for the most part, although I don't think it really started off strong. I really enjoyed where it wound up going. It started to bring in some Star Wars non-canon now characters like Admiral Thrawn, which made fans happy, and I liked the character a lot, too. So he was used pretty well, kind of, again, charting a young boy's growth to becoming a Jedi over time. Yeah, it's kind of like a four-year expansion of the Luke Skywalker character arc in three movies. There's a lot of fun in there, and I firmly, you know, enjoyed where the show ended this week. And it set up a few things, you know, for the future. But that's a whole nother podcast, and we're not doing a Star Wars podcast.
If I might ask, though.
Sure.
Jon Favreau is taking over Star Wars.
Mm-hmm.
Given his past experience, you were mentioning motion capture and CGI. What do you expect more of in this Star Wars TV series? More practical effects, which Star Wars is known for? Or are we going to jump back to the George Lucas prequel style of more CGI and mocap?
Oh boy, I think budgetarily, it's probably going to be a nice balance between the two, just because they're going to have to limit themselves. They'll have that limit of the budget to say, okay, we can't be spending, what's the average budget for a Star Wars film now? $150 million? So we can't be spending $75 million an episode to make this TV show. There's no way that's going to, you know, be cost effective with this streaming service unless they're charging, you know, $2,200 a month for the streaming service or something ridiculous. So I think we're not going to see a lot of entire motion capture characters like Jar Jar or Snoke or anything like that. We're going to see a lot more practical makeup, which will be fun. I don't think we're going to see giant, massive space battles in every episode. They're expensive. And you're going to see, I think you're going to see some differences versus the kind of action and stuff you saw in the animated series, mostly because there might be for slightly different age groups. Also, animation, you don't have as many limitations as to what you can do. If you can draw it, you can pretty much do it. It's just a question of how much time you have to draw everything that you want to add into something. I think it'll be a fun, visually interesting show. It's not going to be super cutting edge the way, you know, the actual Star Wars films are, which might, you know, upset a few folks who don't stop and think about it for a half a second. But, you know, hey, when has fandom ever stopped and thought about something for half a second?
Not really.
No. And I say that as a fan. Let me ask you this. Okay, how big a fan of Star Wars are you? You've seen the movies?
Yes.
Have you read any of the books?
I started in on a couple of them. I have yet to finish one.
Okay, I think that speaks for itself in
a way.
No, not a slight against you. I mean, it's a kind of a gauge of your fandom, and maybe, you know, it's like maybe a gauge of the books as well.
You and I both know that when it comes to Star Wars and Star Trek, I love them equally, but Star Trek always has that little sliver more on Star Wars for me.
Fair enough.
I was raised with both of them at the exact same time, so I have an appreciation for both, and they're both in my collection.
Okay. So, what period of time in the Star Wars timeline would you like to see this show happen? Around the Clone Wars, somewhere between the prequels and the original trilogy, maybe concurrent with the original trilogy, something after the original trilogy, before the new films?
Well, you said it's not going to be starting up until maybe 2019, 2020?
Yeah, I'm sure they'll be, you know, in production by the end of the year.
So, oh, by the end of the year?
Possibly. If not very early 2019, the service doesn't launch until late 2019.
I was thinking maybe post this trilogy. It won't be a direct connection, but for whatever Rian Johnson or D.B. Weiss and Benioff have planned
for their trilogies,
it would be nice to have a bridging the gap between this and theirs. Almost like how Rogue One and Rebels took place in that
time bridges
spirit.
The prequel and the,
yeah,
the original.
And the originals.
Okay. Well, that's a good thought, and that just presupposes, though, that Rian Johnson's new trilogy of Star Wars film and the Game of Thrones trilogy of Star Wars films all take place after this current trilogy
Which
that we're
might.
In. It might.
Or it might not.
Yeah. Everybody's thinking Game of Thrones guys, oh, it's going to be a, you know, Knights of the Old Republic series of films. Maybe, maybe not. Who knows? At this point, we don't know. There's a lot of speculation.
Whatever it is, I'd like to see it connected to those. I think we've had our fill of the time period of from the prequels to the current trilogy. That area for me is all kind of filled in. What happens after? What happens before? That's what I'm interested in knowing.
Okay, so older history of the Republic, maybe how the Jedi became so complacent?
That's a possibility, yes.
Okay, that could be an interesting story.
And as for Knights of the Old Republic, that's a story that hasn't been told yet.
True. I'm not a game fan, so video game guy.
You haven't even started it.
I know, I'm not a video game guy, so all that...
Oh, video game. Yeah, I thought you were going Game of Thrones.
No. Well, yeah, Game of Thrones I need to catch up on, too. I know, it's so embarrassing. And but I think, you know, the Knights of the Old Republic, that's an era that is certainly worth exploring. My question is, everything that we've pretty much seen so far always has ties back to the original Star Wars trilogy. The prequels obviously set up how Anakin Skywalker became a Jedi and then was seduced by the dark side, became Darth Vader, and pretty much ends with the birth of Luke and Leia. The current trilogy we're seeing is kind of dealing with the aftermath of what happened after Empire fell and a New Republic came up. There are still bad guys out there. What kind of personal impact did that have on Leia, Han, Luke? And we've seen that start to play out through the first two films of this trilogy. And even the TV, the cartoons, Clone Wars and Rebels, have connections into those movies and everything. If my concern is the public really going to be interested in a Star Wars movie entirely divorced from everything that we've seen so far and say, oh, no, next series of movies is called Knights of the Old Republic, and it's set 1,000 years before the current Star Wars films that you know and love. Is that going to be too far a remove for the average ticket buyer to go, oh, Star Wars without anybody I know, not even R2-D2 or C-3PO? I don't know.
Well, if you are a true Star Wars fan, I believe that won't change anything.
Probably not.
Because the fact that it's not connected makes me more interested. Which, that's just me.
Okay.
But it would be a nice change of pace to see Star Wars separated from the Skywalker story, which is something that I have been mentioning. Mm-hmm. I mentioned it in my Kylo Ren piece on Film Buff Online,
mm-hmm.
that the way the trilogy is going, it is not going to be a Skywalker story anymore. It's about the little heroes that come out from nowhere instead of the legacy of this family and the events that happen around it.
Wouldn't the events of other people rising up, you know, because they heard the story of Luke Skywalker sort of be that the Skywalker family legacy?
Maybe.
Okay.
What I would like to see, and here's the thing, if you want to connect it back, I'm sure that there is something mentioned in one of the prequel films of the time period of the old Jedi, or maybe we'll see the books from Last Jedi, or if we were to do Knights of the Old Republic or something like that.
Okay.
We would have connections.
Palpatine made mention of the tragedy of Darth Plagueis.
Yeah. So you never know how they'll connect it. I'm sure they will. And it might just be by a prop. But it's something that small and minuscule that if you're not a Star Wars fan, you're going to completely miss it.
Yeah, but I mean, there's a difference, I think, between diehard Star Wars fan and people who are interested in Star Wars because it's part of the pop culture zeitgeist at that moment. And think about people at your day job. Or, you know, average people on the street. They've all seen Star Wars. They all go to the new Star Wars movie the first week or so it comes out, usually. You know, they're not the ones reading the books. They're not the ones consuming the TV show. The audience for those things are always a lot smaller. You know, everybody's like, oh, they should do something on this. And they pick out, like, this one little minute thing out of canon that, again, your average ticket holder is not, the ticket buyer is not.
Well, the same could be said of Marvel.
True.
With Marvel's television shows, yes, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. is a direct link to what is happening in the films,
mm-hmm.
but segue over to Netflix.
Mm-hmm.
They drop hints here and there, they make mentions, but overall, those stories are kept completely separate from what's going on in the MCU.
Mm-hmm.
It's their own little Mary... Merry Men.
Okay.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
Their own little band of brothers.
And honestly, before it dropped on Netflix, if you talked to anybody outside of a comic book shop and said, who's Jessica Jones, they would not have a clue. And which is a shame because the original Jessica Jones comic series, Alias, is one of my favorite Marvel books from the last two decades.
It's actually my favorite as well, and I'm glad I started reading it.
Okay, so we're all thumbs up about a Jon Favreau produced and overseen Star Wars TV series for streaming. Was it a good idea to announce it on Thursday, International Women's Day? Or did Lucasfilm kind of drop the ball there, act a little tone deaf?
On Thursday?
Yeah.
I think that was a good time.
Really?
Yes.
Because as of right now, we have not seen any female creatives in any, you know, the major creative roles, you know, for screenwriting outside of Carrie Fisher doing some
screenwriting, script doctoring,
no. Or directing or producing outside of Kathleen Kennedy, but she's the president of Lucasfilm. So beyond that, though, you know, we still haven't seen any, you know, female directors for this series. We've got two other film trilogies being developed. Overseen by guys. Some people online are a little upset by that. They wanted to see, you know, a woman in charge of a project. I personally just want to see good people in charge of projects, and there are plenty of good directors and screenwriters and producers who are female out there who would probably do a great job with Star Wars.
Well, I think you're kind of jumping the gun there.
Hmm.
First of all, the rest of the cast and crew has yet to be decided.
True.
For this TV show. And as of late, Star Wars is killing it with their female leads. Rogue One,
mm-hmm.
You've got Jyn Erso. In this new trilogy, you have Rey. She's the main freaking character. Mm-hmm. So maybe that might be a hint. You never know.
Well, I mean, okay, on screen, representation is looking good. On the creative side, maybe we'll see. I mean, I would love, I'm sure we'll see a couple of females in the writer's room for this show.
Inclusion writer.
Inclusion writer, yes. Frances McDormand will now be writing for Star Wars, I think is what we're saying. No, we're joking, and this is how internet rumors get started.
But I think maybe dropping that on International Women's Day after Frances McDormand made that speech at the Oscars on Sunday and mentioned the inclusion writer. Just this week, Michael B. Jordan's production company has stated that from now on, they will use the inclusion writer on all forthcoming projects. Mm-hmm. So you never know. That might actually play into this.
That's true. That's true. I mean, yeah, it is way too early.
Yeah.
To really start casting stones at a project. Again, it's never stopped fandom before. In fact, I was thinking about this just now. George Lucas's daughter, Katie, wrote a couple of episodes of Rebels, and I believe a couple of episodes of Clone Wars. I just remember, you know, seeing some animated Star Wars stuff that she had her name on. That was pretty darn solid. So I know people bag on George Lucas as a screenwriter. But maybe, you know, if his daughter gets in there and is contributing, that might be a good thing, too, for multiple reasons.
She would know the world.
Yes. Yes, indeed.
Speaking of television,
and in this case, it's TV going to the movies, not movies going to TV. The Sopranos is getting a prequel film. New Line has picked up the rights from David Chase, the creator of the classic HBO series The Sopranos, to do a prequel set in the 1960s during the Newark race riots called The Many Saints of Newark. I know Sopranos fans are pretty excited. And on top of Game of Thrones, Sopranos is another series I have not watched. Which makes me, again, a bad person.
I'm right there with you.
Okay.
I have not seen a single episode of The Sopranos. I don't even know how to talk about this.
No, I mean, I think it's exciting that, you know, I'm happy for fans of the show. They get to see, you know, some backstory to a lot of characters. I'm just looking at the Deadline news story on this one, and they're saying that the time period would allow them to probably use the characters of Tony Soprano's dad, Johnny Boy, and a younger version of his wife, Livia, who was played on the TV series by Nancy Marchand. Also a younger version of Tony's uncle, Junior. And those are fan favorite characters. So that certainly will, you know, should please a lot of people. I know people have been, there's a lot of HBO series that people keep hoping gets movie treatments. Deadwood is another.
I think this one has been bouncing around for a while, hasn't it?
True. And David Chase has not done anything in a few years now. So he was due to have some kind of project. And so it's not surprising that that project will be a Sopranos movie. In fact, the last thing David Chase did was 2010's Not Fade Away, which got some good reviews and did terrible at the box office, unfortunately.
No, the one HBO show I wish would go to film? Newsroom.
Oh, Newsroom? Newsroom would be fun, but I'd rather see that continue as just a TV series, you know, because season long prequel film.
Yeah, maybe Mac and Will McAvoy when they're younger, and maybe the story of how they broke apart and all that.
Okay,
like maybe how they first met.
So it'd be set like in the 90s.
It wasn't the 90s, was it? Let's see, we
90s, early 2000s. I don't know. I'd have to go back and kind of rewatch the Newsroom to pick up the bits and backstory.
Yeah, I think the years that it's set in is 2011 to 2013, I think.
Somewhere in there, yeah.
And so I would say maybe go back at most 10 years.
Okay.
And so it would be a nice way of converging the two.
Mm-hmm.
Because we hear a lot about their backstory in the show, but it's always just kind of lingered there.
The thing with that, though, is as much as I enjoy their characters and everything, you'd have to set that against some sort of news event or ongoing news story. And yeah, maybe setting it against
2001.
Yeah, well,
9/11.
Well, you have that, but in post, you know, just entering into that post 9/11 world, scary time for everybody involved, trying to figure out what that meant. Mm-hmm. And maybe Will is not that great at relationships, so that becomes a parallel to him entering into a relationship with Mac. And he's kind of nervous about that. I don't know. I'm kind of spitballing here, and it's probably a terrible idea and a terrible parallel to draw. But over that time of the Bush administration and trying to figure everything out, I don't know. It could be interesting if you find the right news stories to contrast the story of their relationship against. Because I think the newsroom is at its best when it's kind of delving into the reportage process and how they... people on the show are like stand-ins for the real journalists that, you know, exposed certain stories and showing you that process and how that works, which I think is very important.
Well, my favorite episode actually is the episode where we got Bin Laden.
Mm-hmm.
For some odd reason, that one makes a very strong impression. Everyone has seen the first 8 minutes of the newsroom. It flies around Facebook all the time about the famous Jeff Daniels monologue of how America is not the greatest country in the world anymore. And it was actually those first 8 minutes that made me want to sit down and watch the show.
Mm-hmm.
If they did a newsroom film, I have one condition. Aaron Sorkin must write it.
Of course, of course. I'd still like to see... I was really disappointed that the newsroom didn't end with, because the whole last season dealt with their network financial issues and everything. I really wanted to see the show end with their news network being bought up by the company that owns the sports network on Sports Night, and it's all just one big giant universe. Or have I watched too many Marvel movies now, and I just want a Sorkinverse?
You want a universe for everything.
I know. I love that.
What was the one we were talking about the other day?
Comic book writers?
Yes.
Yeah. Professor Marston and the Wonder Woman spins off a whole comic creators universe, and then you have another movie about Siegel and Schuster, who created Superman, and then something about Will Gaines, who created Mad Magazine and fought against the comic book creation of the comic book code. And the big villain through all of this is, of course, the guy who wrote Seduction of the Innocents and tried to get comic books banned because he is an evil man and he lied a lot. He actually lied and faked a lot of his quote-unquote research and studies because, well, he was a jerk. And and the less said about him, the better.
And yet you want him as the main villain.
I know. Wortham as a villain would be a whole lot of fun. I think. Anyways, but that's it for the news right now. We'll be back in just a moment with a look at a couple of the new trailers that have come out this week.
Emergency meeting this weekend. I promised my wife and daughter I'd take them away this weekend, sir.
We need to cut 20%.
You promised these people good jobs.
I thought you'd do anything for this company.
Well, have a good time.
For the Christopher Robin trailer. Wow. What's your first thoughts on it, Rich?
Well, interesting. Disney is basically telling the story of an older Christopher Robin who rediscovers the magic of his childhood. So it's Hook with the Winnie the Pooh characters, I think.
Hey.
First of all.
That's not exactly a good comparison you want to make, considering Hook wasn't that good.
Hook was a...
But yeah, it's fun.
Hook was fun. I know it has its fans out there, but it's not Spielberg's best.
Yeah.
But for this looks like, this looks interesting at least. It looks a little bit more serious and thoughtful take on it. The person doing Pooh's voice is great. Who is that?
Jim Cummings, who has played Winnie the Pooh several times since, hold on, I think it is like 1997.
Okay. He's a great, great stand-in for the departed Sterling Holloway there, who, of course, played Pooh's voice originally for the Disney shorts.
Yeah. 1997 is when he started playing Pooh, and he has done it ever since.
Wow.
For every single direct-to-video or any Pooh story, the Tigger movie, all of that.
Guess once you land that voice role, it's yours for a while. who else is in the cast?
Are we talking main cast or voice cast?
Oh, let's go through the voice cast, because I think those are the characters everybody knows and are excited about maybe seeing in live action.
Well, we already went through Winnie the Pooh.
Yes.
Chris O'Dowd is Tigger.
That's always good. Chris O'Dowd in anything is good.
Yes. Film gets... any film with Chris O'Dowd gets the Jennifer Connelly treatment in my mind.
Jennifer Connelly role?
Yes.
It's automatically 30% better with Chris O'Dowd in it?
Yes.
As any film with Jennifer Connelly is automatically 30% better? Including House of Sand and Fog?
Oh, yeah. Well, considering that Chris O'Dowd was in Cloverfield Paradox.
One of the few high points in that awful movie.
Exactly my point.
Okay.
Brad Garrett as Eeyore. I'm not so familiar with Brad Garrett.
He's the older brother from...
Everybody Loves Raymond, right?
Everybody Loves Raymond, yes.
Okay.
So that's really good casting. Even if they just model Eeyore's eyes on his eyes.
Toby Jones as Owl.
Ooh, okay.
I love Toby Jones.
Toby Jones is fantastic.
There is nothing that he's ever done that I'm not a fan of.
Okay.
I'm not familiar with the voice cast for Piglet. Nick Mohammed.
Nick Mohammed. Not ringing a bell for me.
Mm-mm. This is the one I'm most excited for, though. Peter Capaldi as Rabbit.
That should be a lot of fun. Man.
I can actually picture it, though.
I was only kind of half sold on this movie, to be quite honest, based on the trailer. But yeah, you throw Peter Capaldi at me, I'm like, okay, I'm there. I am so there.
Sophie Okonedo as Kanga. I love Sophie. She's got this very warm demeanor to her, which it makes for a perfect motherly kangaroo. Wyatt Dean Hall as Rue. I'm not familiar with the name at all. But now for main cast. Take it away, Rich.
Okay, well, we've got Hayley Atwell in there as it looks to be Christopher Robin's wife, Evelyn. His boss, played by Mark Gatiss. So basically, we're looking at a ridiculous lineup of genre British actors who have appeared in a lot of comedy and science fiction stuff.
And also are rather small, I would say. They're big in their following, but outside of that, aren't very well known.
True. But they're all solid actors.
Yes.
As well. So it looks thematically similar, though, to another trailer that dropped this week for Mary Poppins Returns. Actually, it kind of premiered during the Oscars, and so we didn't actually have a chance to talk about it last weekend in our Oscar wrap-up. But there's very, very little to the trailer, with the exception of some teases and some winks to the past about the children's kite, with the kite tail being the suffragette's sash, and we see Bert back, and then suddenly Mary Poppins arrives, and she says one cute, adorable thing, and the trailer's over.
You might want to fix something there. That's not
what?
Bert.
Oh, that's he's playing a different chimney sweep?
Yes.
Oh, okay. I thought he was actually playing Bert again.
No, because...
Okay, I sit corrected here.
Ben Whishaw's character in this film is the young Mike... I believe it was Michael Banks?
Yes.
grown up.
Okay.
So that would make that it would make sense that the chimney sweep is no longer Bert.
Okay.
Considering Lin-Manuel Miranda is playing him and not an older actor.
Okay, that does make sense. And but honestly, and this is probably because I haven't seen Mary Poppins since I was a kid, I always felt that Bert had a little bit of magic to him as well. Just because, you know, dancing on the rooftops with the other chimney sweeps, he seemed to be able to jump into the chalk drawing stuff with Mary. You know, it just kind of, well, he, you know, maybe it's because my point of view as a kid going, well, if he's an adult, he's hanging out with Mary, he's probably magic as well.
Child at heart, I would say.
Oh,
someone who,
most definitely.
Someone who hasn't lost the magic. But considering we saw him dancing with the other chimney sweeps, and they all seem to have that same magic, could it be said that all chimney sweeps are magic?
That's an interesting question. I like that. I like that. That kind of opens up the world in a weird, wonderful way.
I'm going to go back and watch Mary Poppins again. I just bought it this week, finally, so I'll be able to sit down and rewatch it.
Okay, yeah, according to the IMDb, Lin-Manuel Miranda's character is not Bert, but is named Jack. Apparently all chimney sweeps, based on just these two examples, can only have a four-letter first name that ends in a hard consonant sound.
Wow. Jeez.
Well, just on a sample size of two, I think that's scientific enough, right?
Yeah. Who else is filling out the cast for Mary Poppins Returns? We have Emily Blunt as the titular character. Mm-hmm. Lin-Manuel Miranda is Jack. He's an apprentice, actually, to Bert.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
But Dick Van Dyke will be back playing a character by the name of Mr. Dawes Jr. We've got Meryl Streep showing up, Colin Firth.
Julie Walters. Julie Walters.
Angela Lansbury.
Ooh.
David Warner, I love David Warner whenever he shows up.
He's playing the Admiral.
Mm-hmm. Wow, Jim Norton. No, I was thinking of the comic Jim Norton. This is a different Jim Norton. So I was like, that Jim Norton, the comic Jim Norton. Great stand-up comic should not be allowed anywhere near a children's film. No.
Speaking
and
of
he would be the first one to agree.
True. Speaking of Newsroom, Emily Mortimer is going to be in Mary Poppins Returns.
Great.
As is Jeremy Swift. So, solid cast here.
Solid cast again, yeah. The thing is, though, both of these stories look like they tread the same, like I said, they tread the same thematical idea that as adults, you work too hard and you need this bit of magic to come into your life to get you to reconnect to your family, which is a nice idea. But I find it kind of an odd story for Hollywood to be telling when in Hollywood, you really have to work you really have to throw yourself into your career. And oftentimes you don't have time to connect with your family. Speaking of bringing joy back into someone's life or reuniting some magic in their life. That's also the theme of the film for the next trailer we're going to look at from Illumination Studios, the folks that brought us Despicable Me and a million spin-offs from that, comes a new version of The Grinch.
Today, we will do mean things, and we will do them in style.
Oh, hello. Happy holidays.
No. Bad trailer. Bad, bad, bad.
So you're saying you don't like the trailer for Illumination's The Grinch. Wow. I've never seen you hiss at anything before. Like an angry cat. Oh, boy. Yeah. I think I am on record somewhere as not loving the Jim Carrey version of The Grinch Who Stole Christmas.
I didn't like it either.
It's just the characterization of the Whoville residents as all about Christmas and all about Christmas and all about the presents and all about spending and spending and, you know, and all the craziness. They're the ones who have kind of overlooked the reason for the season, if you will. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly the second everything's gone, they're like, oh, okay, hold on. We'll hold hands and sing a song now. It just didn't feel right to me. This can't get a good feel for what's happening here, except it looks horrible. And apparently the Grinch wears tighty-whities and then puts on pants that look exactly like his skin, which is horribly disturbing.
It's like SpongeBob getting dressed.
Oh, my God.
Doesn't it remind you of the scene in the SpongeBob trailers where he would pull out his suit and he would put it on?
Yes.
It's the same concept. And
I don't think we need to see cartoon characters getting dressed.
No. And then you're right. The lamp and the picture frame on the other side of the chasm. How does he change the light bulb?
Yeah, it's a beautiful piece of design, but it's like the first time I saw this trailer, I looked at it and went, what? Huh? It's okay. I sort of like the idea that Illumination is kind of playing off the absolutely irritating quality of the song Happy, which originally is from their film, Despicable Me. So they're having a little bit of fun there. So I give them points for that. Mm-hmm. But beyond that, there is nothing in this trailer, and that includes Benedict Cumberbatch, who, again, another great Brit who we all enjoy, whose work mm-hmm. we love. I'm just like...
I could see him doing this in real life.
Oh, yeah. I maybe would watch video of the recording sessions for this.
Yeah, as would I, but I don't want to see the film. There's nothing about it that is striking me at all. As much as I hate inflatable...
Christmas ornaments?
Christmas decorations. Somehow, it was rather satisfying to see one blow up and smack him across the...
Okay, so that joke worked for you. But beyond that, though, nothing really worked for me in this trailer in terms of, oh, the Grinch, she, you know, pukes a pickle back into a jar. Well, and
first of all, like, supermarket mm-hmm. in Whoville. Why is he going there? He never leaves his cave. That was actually something stated.
I know. He's more in tune with the town. I don't get how this all works.
And they're not afraid of him. They're playing it off like, okay, he goes there every day.
He's just the cranky neighbor. He doesn't live up on a hill. Or maybe he does.
He's the town grump.
Yeah.
I was going to say town Grinch, but he is the Grinch.
Yes, of course. I mean, obviously, you know, we're seeing selected moments all of, you know, 2.5 minutes worth in a trailer for a movie that's probably going to run 90 minutes or so, 100 minutes. So obviously we're not getting all the context we need here. But what I do see is not enticing me to go see this movie.
No, I'm going to scold this trailer like he scolded Max.
You shouted no at that trailer. Like it was a bad puppy dog who just pooped on the rug.
Bad Max.
And I've seen a lot of bad trailers that pooped on the rug, metaphorically. But that was the first time I've seen anybody treat a trailer like that.
It deserved it.
Okay.
Now that we're wrapping up The Grinch with the idea that it could be a potentially bad adaptation of a mm-hmm. children's classic, let's now look at an actual bad adaptation of a children's classic. She just wants to be beautiful. She goes unnoticed. She knows no limits. You can't keep using your father's disappearance as an excuse to act out, Meg. He's not coming back, is he? Don't give up hope. Oh, she don't see the light that's shining. Is that his work? What's it about? He believes that we can travel the universe instantaneously. So you fall to space? More likely wrinkle it. You must really miss him. More than anything in the universe. Then how about we go and find him? Let's go! Dad was right. It really is possible. This is my favorite planet in the entire galaxy. There's a hope that's waiting for you in the dark. Who are you? We are in search of warriors. Your father has done an extraordinary thing, but he may be in danger. Your father's alive. We believe he is, and the only one who can find him is you. You're kidding. Do I look like I'm kidding? A little. I'm not.
I'm not.
In 1963, young adult author Madeline Lingle first introduced the world to plucky teen Meg Murray and her friends in the novel A Wrinkle in Time. The Newbery Award-winning novel was a heady mixture of adventure, science fiction, and more than a dash of spirituality that at the time of its publication drew detractors as well as fans. Over the decades, the detractors have fallen away, while consecutive generations of new fans have thrilled to Meg and her friends journeying across the universe to find her missing father and to stop a force of evil known only as the It, all the while being aided on their quest by a trio of angelic beings, Mrs. What's-It, Mrs. Who, and Mrs. Witch. Producer Catherine Hand had been trying to bring the book's story to the big screen for nearly four decades, and at last she has succeeded with the $100 million budgeted feature film that has opened in theaters this past weekend. Directed by Selma's Ava DuVernay, it stars relative newcomer Storm Reid as Meg, alongside such names as Oprah Winfrey, Reese Witherspoon, Mindy Kaling, and Chris Pine. While the film does bring some of the amazing vistas described in Lingle's book to vivid life, it also loses a few things, including the characters of Meg's twin brothers, an alien known as Aunt Beast, and a side trip to a two-dimensional planet. So, Natasha, does the film do justice to Lingle's book? Or for that matter, is it a good film all on its own?
I'm just going to say this right now.
Okay.
Blech.
Concise and to the point.
Yes, exactly.
You. I know we both saw it together.
Why say many words when I can make a sound and it's still, you know, drops yes. every word there.
Yes, I know. I saw this with you on Thursday night and along with a few other people. And I think everybody in our group was not thrilled with this movie. It was a hot mess.
I think as we were walking out, someone asked us, was it good? And all four of us turned around and said it simultaneously. No.
Yeah, it was. We couldn't have choreographed that any better. I don't know where to start with this movie. I mean, I'm going to start with a few good things, I think. I think Storm Reid was great as Meg.
Yes.
She was ballsy as the kid I remember reading about when I was a kid reading this book. I think visually the film is very lush.
I think every scene with Chris Pine was actually the best scenes in the film because for some odd reason he brings this this sympathy.
Mm-hmm.
And he's able to carry over what are really poorly written lines.
Oh, there's poorly written lines for everybody in this movie.
But he makes everybody it seem so effortless.
True. Everybody gets some garbage lines to speak.
I swear Oprah Winfrey had a section where it sounded like Yoda. I'm not kidding. The whole fear leads to anger. Anger leads to hate. Hate leads to suffering. She actually did that, but it was just rewritten.
True.
So it doesn't sound exactly like that.
And there's the scene where they arrive on the planet that's been overtaken by the It and where everybody is all conforming to each other. And Meg's friend Calvin turns to her and goes, I smell food, like good roasted food.
You actually wrote that down.
Yeah, I had to write that down. It was just appallingly bad. Now, it might have been an actual line in the book, and honestly, it's been decades since I've read the thing, so I couldn't tell you. Somebody might have sit there and was typing while looking at the book and typing a script, but no one ever read that aloud and said, yes, let's use that line as it is intact.
Yeah, but
no kid speaks like that.
No, and they were able to update some other lines, such as Mindy Kaling's Mrs. Who.
Yes.
Talks through quotes said by other people.
Mm-hmm.
And they updated some, so at she goes, dang!
Yeah,
Tucker.
She gives a Chris Tucker reference. She also quoted Outkast, yes. Which was fun. And I liked that. I was like, okay, yeah, let's kind of update that. They
And yet they couldn't update good roasted food if that's an actual line.
No. They kind of made the fact that Meg was being bullied in school and was a troubled child in school feel very current and of the moment, mm-hmm. which I liked a lot. The teachers that her younger brother overhears discussing her problems, though, was, I'm sure teachers gossip. I have friends who are teachers, and I know they gossip about their students between themselves and their colleagues. But at the same time, that whole sequence, which is just really a giant exposition dump into the film, just was written so stiltily and poorly that it was just like, it stood out like a sore thumb.
And it wasn't even portrayed. I felt like they got the worst actors in Hollywood to play wooden characters mm-hmm. right there. Like, they didn't... the bully felt more real than the teachers mm-hmm. did.
And I don't know, is the bully character actually from the book or not?
You're asking the wrong person.
Okay, so it's been a while since you read it as well.
It's been about 10 years, and I started back up on it this week. Mm-hmm. I think I got through the first chapter or two, or chapter and a half, before I had other things to do, unfortunately. But I did enjoy that the scene where Charles Wallace is making hot milk for Coco.
Mm-hmm.
For Meg, that was all there. But then they take a bit of time, and that was the night that Mrs. Watson walks through the door in the sheet.
Yes.
Like, they don't mess around in the book. They get right down to it. Oh, she's walking right through the door at that moment.
Mm-hmm. The film at the beginning felt very choppy. There was a lot of exposition they were dropping in, a lot of explanations about characters and stuff.
At the beginning, the exposition carries out the whole way.
I have a note here that I wrote down, the first note I wrote as we were watching this, quote, "Holy shit, the exposition," unquote. It was ridiculous. And yet, the one piece of exposition that really would have helped the film, I think, they don't have in there. And it's something that we saw in the trailers for the film, where Meg is explaining how, you know, tesseracting works and they're wrinkling space. She's explaining it to Calvin and she has the string and the plastic yes. ants and everything. That scene is not in the movie. There's some vague talk about, oh, her dad thinks there's a way to travel through space, but he disappeared 4 years ago and everybody thought he was nuts anyways. Everybody's like, oh, yeah, he's nuts. That's impossible. And suddenly she's doing it almost by accident once the Mrs. W's start showing up. And I was like, wait, I don't get, okay, her dad was saying something about it, but they don't actually explain the process at all. It's just all of a sudden they're magically moving through space to another planet. Okay, yeah, I read the books years ago, and so I sort of remember, you know, exactly how this is supposed to be working. But just in the terms of a movie by itself, it's a horrible, horrible omission that just leaves, you know, has the potential to leave the audience lost. As to go, wait, what? Okay, things get a little wobbly and then they just take a walk and suddenly they're on another planet. I don't get it.
There's also a 5-6 minute section in that film, while mm-hmm. whilst it looks beautiful, does nothing for the story. And it's when Mrs. Watson turns into this beautiful flying creature mm-hmm. and they climb on its back, on her back, and they're flying up
with the artichoke hair.
Yeah, the artichoke hair. and they're flying through the sky and they love the idea that they can lift off a little and they're floating on the mm-hmm. air on her back. And then Calvin falls. And then they arrive back down to Earth. Did you find anything? No.
No, nothing happened. Well, actually, in that sequence, they do see the It for the first time. That helps introduce that. And the sequence...
I'm sorry, but in the next shot, we can see the It in the background. Yeah,
they could be just
them.
Standing there.
They could have said something while they were standing there instead of, oh, let's take us for a scenic route around this planet and do nothing for the story.
The only other thing I think that scene does contribute is Meg is the first one to realize that they can kind of float or fly above the transformed Mrs. Witch just because of, you know, general science principles.
Yeah,
lift and drag. I think she says something about that. So it does kind of show that she's very smart and can realize these things, but there are 100 other ways you could have done that in the script without this whole long sequence.
I agree. And it doesn't help. It doesn't help the story. It does nothing for it, actually. And even though it shows her to be smart, we get that later on. We get, actually, in the next scene. So, why? And we don't need to prove that she's smart. Everyone has said since the beginning of this story that she is smart. She's just troubled because her dad went missing. So
yeah.
She's slacking on her studies. Mm-hmm. She's brilliant.
She's acting out.
Maybe it might be for attention. Maybe she's hoping her dad might hear something and come back. Even if just to scold her. But it didn't need to be there. And the flight, even whilst it proves how clever she is. That doesn't come into play later on in the story, so why does it need to be there?
Okay. Yeah, we don't see any of the Mrs. W's transform into anything else at any point. It's just, okay, they're kind of otherworldly beings and they can do this. Whoopity-doo.
Yeah. And the editing. Can we talk the editing?
The editing? There feels like there is a better, longer version of this movie. And it's just been, you know, everything got sliced down. So it's just, you know, only an hour and 49 minutes. There's probably like a 2-hour and 5-minute version of this movie somewhere out there.
Probably.
Because, like I said, a lot of stuff feels very choppy. It kind of moves from thing to thing, especially in the beginning.
It's very bad. Poor transitions. Very poor transitions.
The choppiness and the lack of flow in this movie makes me wonder, is this an editing issue or was this a script issue? But again, you know, we saw some stuff in the trailers that did make it into the final movie that probably would have benefited it. So I have a feeling it's more of an editing issue rather than a screenplay issue. The one thing I do see with the screenplay, though, this book, from what I've, you know, read more recently when I've kind of been doing a little background brush up on the series, was Madeline Lingle kind of trying to work out her own thoughts and feelings on her own spirituality, her own religion. And later years, she was a Episcopalian, very active in the New York Episcopalian Church. I don't get a sense of any of that in this movie at all.
No.
I don't get any of it. And, you know, from what I've been reading, you know, I want to go back and read this book now because it's talking about how, you know, how science and the idea of spirituality and the idea that there is a God or a godlike being out there can kind of exist hand in hand. Science doesn't necessarily preclude religion. Religion doesn't necessarily preclude science, I think is a great idea, sort of where my mindset is.
I think that's a society issue. At the time, religion and science were butting heads in the 60s.
Well, they certainly are now. I mean,
yes, they are now, but I'm Catholic. I still Ditto. Go to church, or I at least try to every Sunday. I don't always make it there. I can walk in and count on one hand the number of people younger than me, and I'm 23,
mm-hmm.
who are at church.
Not there, like, with their parents, but on their own, you mean?
At all.
Okay.
At all. And I feel that maybe our society is kind of distancing themselves from the idea of religion in favor of science. So there isn't a big push and pull between the two anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Because it feels like the scales have tipped. Religion isn't as first and foremost in people's brains anymore.
I would think in certain... I would think you have a point to a... To a certain point, I think it might be kind of like geographical, you know, and not without traveling other parts of the country
of
to
course.
Really kind of confirm this. But I, you know, have to wonder if, you know, in the South, are they more religious and they're not so much science? You read studies about how certain areas of the country don't value higher education as much as other regions of the country might. You get through school to a certain point, and then you're good to go off and have your job. And I think maybe we are drifting a little bit further afield from discussing A Wrinkle in Time than I thought we would get. So I want to kind of circle that back around. Do you think that maybe some of the spiritual overtones of the book were kind of stripped out of the movie, either because of A, bad editing, or B, that they just kind of don't want to alienate people who are away from spirituality and are more of a, you know, more in a scientifically based world, and that's it. And with that where they exclude certain amounts of spirituality.
I think it's more of the latter. Mm-hmm. Ava DuVernay put together a cast and crew that is very diversified and is paving the way in this industry.
Okay.
So would it make sense that she would try to push forward science as a way of higher education and how education can open up new doors? Maybe she sees religion as stunting it a bit.
That's possible. If that was the case, though, then I would say, if that was her mindset, that she thinks religion stunts intellectual growth, I think that's kind of antithetical to what Lingle was talking about or exploring in the book, maybe. And from what little, you know, granted, I've not read, I mean, there was a great biography that came out last year about her, from what I understand. And, you know, just from my reading, it doesn't feel like that was Lingle's mindset when she wrote the book. So maybe for that reason, for that thematic reason, DuVernay might not have been the best choice. I mean, visually, the film is stunning.
Yes.
There's some interesting shot choices in here that make me scratch my head and go, is this a little too arty for a family film from Disney? There's one moment where two characters are talking, and the two characters are at the extreme left and right of the screen, so much so that you only get they're in profile to us. So much so, though, they're so extremely to the sides of the screen that you barely just see their eyes, their nose, and their lips jutting into the screen, and that's it. And I was like, that was really weirdly framed, and it just stood out to me so much. So it makes me, you know, wonder, you know, DuVernay turned in a beautiful film that is, like I said, a hot mess, though, storytelling-wise. So was this the best project for her or not? I don't know. And that's something, you know, I would like to, you know, read some interviews with her about that and try to find a little bit more about the process of this movie.
I have to ask, considering you brought up the idea of science and religion and Wrinkle in Time and children's mm-hmm. adaptations, what are your thoughts on the new adaptation of His Dark Materials?
I'm interested in seeing that. That'll be interesting.
That's another children's adaptation or children's
young adult
series mm-hmm. that deals with similar issues of science and religion.
I would like to see them give that a go again, because the first time they tried to launch that as a franchise, it kind of stalled on the launch pad there.
Yeah.
And again, I'm not sure why that did. I don't think it kind of got into too many religious elements.
And I don't think it took the risks that it could have.
Okay.
They actually cut the last 15 to 20 minutes of that movie.
Yeah, because, well, they had filmed it. They wanted to save it to be the kickoff to the second film.
But I think if they had used it, it would have had a better... It takes chances. It actually kills mm-hmm. a character.
Ooh.
A child. Right at the end of that book.
Yikes.
And that would have been a good jump. Instead mm-hmm. of, okay, we have this battle, let's calm everything down and segue into the next one. If it's that calm, you have nothing to leave as a cliffhanger to interest them the next time.
True. But, you know, again, I'm not against spirituality in films. And you can adapt material that has spiritual content to it, to the big screen, and do it well without it being like a hammer you over the head obvious Christian film like God's Not Dead, where it's where they always seem to be leading from the point of here is the message and we're going to build a story around it, as opposed to here's the story and here's the message inside.
Yeah.
The Narnia books, I think
those are great adaptations.
C.S. Lewis was obviously dealing with a lot of Catholic symbology when he wrote those books, you know, Aslan being, you know, the obvious allegory to Jesus in these books. Even J.R.R. Tolkien managed to have a couple of broad Catholic ideas, Christian ideas, in The Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit, mostly in the background, about how Middle Earth was created in a perfect state of being, but then evil comes in and it's now in a state of decline because of that evil. You know, it's very much a kind of a Catholic or Christian worldview where creation was perfect and then Satan came in and screwed it up for the rest of us. In fact, there's a great book by a Tolkien scholar by the name of Corey Olson where he talks about the Christian influences in The Hobbit. It's out there. I apologize, I can't remember the name of it. I'm just remembering it now. I read it a couple of years ago. It's fantastic. If you're interested in that kind of thing, I would recommend hunting that down on Amazon.
getting back to
try to put a show. I'll try to put an Amazon link in the show notes for that.
Getting back to Wrinkle in Time, yes. Though, is there anything that stood out to you
in a positive way? Storm Reid was great. I think she was really good, Meg.
I like,
as I said before,
I like the actor who was playing Charles Wallace.
He was pretty good, but once
once we got to the third act,
he felt like he was overplaying it a little bit.
Probably.
We're trying to keep it semi-spoiler free for everybody. There was a great sense of wonder about some of the movie, especially once they first journeyed to that first planet. We had a lot of that where Mrs. Watsit transforms and it's a whole big long sequence that looks beautiful. It's a great sense of wonder, and they're running around this planet and there's these weird flower type people and everything. And Oprah's 10 feet tall while everybody else is regular size. And it's very beautiful and stunning, but as a lot of that, as we said before, just comes at the expense of telling a story.
I have to admit, Oprah being 10 feet high, is that are they trying to tell us something there?
About Oprah?
About Oprah? She's larger than the least. Yeah,
I think we already knew that. Yes, exactly.
stand out to me. And we forgot to mention him, Zach Galifianakis.
Oh yes, as the happy medium.
Yes.
That's one change from the book I don't actually care about, because in the book the character is female.
And
Zach Galifianakis is just delightful and fun. He brings just the right amount of wit and humor to the role without going full Zach Galifianakis on
it. Yeah, and he was very warm. Extremely warm, to the point that, like, I could have swore I saw a couple tears welling up in his eyes at one point. I wanted to reach through the screen and give him a hug.
He's because I'll admit, I'm not a big fan of The Hangover, and his character there is, I find it him irritating, not
yes,
funny.
Thank
you. I keep that character from me. At a distance, just because I don't like him. But here, I was like, okay, yeah, this is a cool guy. Yeah, he's a little cranky that people are showing up and are bugging him with questions at first.
What do you expect?
Yeah. Well, all hermits are cool and cranky.
Yeah.
So I did like that. Let me ask you this, though. When Meg and Calvin are running from that large exploding cloud thing once they're on
like
the planet
tornado,
of the It. Yeah, that tornado, whatever. And they get into the... into the hollowed out dead tree.
Yeah.
And to escape using, again, physics and math. Did you have the briefest flash like I did to Indiana Jones and the Crystal Skull and think, oh my God, they just crawled into a fridge.
Fridge. Yeah, I did actually. Segueing for just a second into Calvin and Meg. That's a relationship there that they were teasing us through the entire film, and I felt that they didn't follow through.
You don't think they paid that off fully at the end?
No, I don't.
You think maybe they were holding some back because they were hoping to do the next book in the series as a sequel?
Maybe. The thing about A Wrinkle in Time, though, is...
It is a self-contained story.
Yes. Sequels are not guaranteed. And if you have a story like this in which everything has its endpoint... why not wrap it up just so you won't be annoying
your audience?
Your audience.
No, you make a good point. I think you kind of speak to...
And they hung on a lot of things with Calvin and Meg. There was the scene at the stream.
Mm-hmm.
That particular scene. And then there's, okay, I'm going to jump into this hollowed out tree with you. And the way that they
I trust you.
Yeah.
There's the whole moment of, do you trust me?
Yes.
And then they run back towards the tornado thing to get into that hollow tree to make their escape.
And the way that they were holding each other and all that. It's obvious. It's obvious from the get-go, their attraction. And yet they didn't pay it off.
True. But like you said, all sequels are not guaranteed, and you kind of hit the nail on the head in the problem with franchise films or launching a what you hope will be a franchise film, especially based on a series of novels, the way Wrinkle in Time, spawned. But Lingle, when she wrote it, wasn't counting on sequels. She just wrote a story that had a definite end. And then once it made a boatload of money, she said, I need another boatload of money. Let's write a sequel. Or maybe her editor said, you know, we all here at the publishing house would like a boatload of money again. So let's write another book and another. And ultimately, there's, what, 4 sequels?
Yeah.
Wow. Shows you how long ago I read these books. When I read them, there was only 2.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. And I'll admit, you know, I enjoyed all 3 of the books. I read them probably a couple of times. Maybe pre-teen, pre-movie nerd Rich might have had a slight literary crush on Meg.
She was the Hermione Granger of the time.
I like that. I like that comparison. So, yeah, unfortunately, you know, I'm not comparing this to the book at all because, like I said, my memories of the book are too far, you know, far too gone to really bring into play here. But just as a movie, I found it very, very disappointing.
Extremely.
Nothing. I would recommend seeing it maybe on a matinee because of the visuals and how beautiful it is. But just be prepared that portions of the story are not going to make a lick of sense.
Wait till it drops to streaming. That's really? What I'm saying.
You don't even think seeing like that first planet on the big screen and everything is worth it?
No, because whilst the visual is stunning on the first planet,
okay,
that whole chunk there does nothing for the story.
True.
Nothing at all. And therefore is wasted on me.
Okay, well, let us reach a happy medium and maybe suggest if you're seeing something else at the theater and you have a chance to sneak in and just catch a part of Wrinkle in Time, do that.
Wait, are you suggesting sneaking into a movie?
Certainly not.
Okay. Oh, boy.
Yeah. Okay. And on that note, I think we're going to wrap up our review here of Wrinkle in Time. We'll be back in just a moment with a few recommendations. Some people stay, some people move. Tough times don't last, but tough people do. As long as you've got hope, you'll find your way. There's power in the thoughts that you think, there's power in the words you say. Like I can. I am, no fear. Today, I saw a rainbow in the rain. As we're wrapping up this week's episode, we would like to leave you with a few recommendations. Natasha, what do you have?
Well, this week I felt like going back and rewatching the 1995 film GoldenEye, which kicked off the Pierce Brosnan era of James Bond 007 films. It is one of my favorites. It has my favorite Bond theme, actually. It's a lot of fun, but the film itself is starting to feel dated in some areas.
How so?
The technology.
Okay.
There's a particular scene where one of the Bond girls needs to send out a message. So she goes into a Russian version, I guess you could say, of, I wouldn't say Radio Shack, because it feels like she's buying right from the, what would you say, the company that...
Manufacturer?
Yeah, the manufacturer. Okay. Thank you. And she goes in, and she's saying, you know, I need these IBM processors and all that, and you're sitting there going, dude, that's before dial-up.
I just suddenly have this image of James Bond trying to use AOL and Q giving him a disc. Here you are, 007.
But
use this magic disc and it'll get you onto the World Wide Web. This is what we're calling it.
But there are other parts to it that are enjoyable. The jokes are still there. Mm-hmm. The actors of the... In the film, you have Sean Bean as your villain, Famke Janssen as our main Bond girl. If there's one thing I love about a Bond film, it's always the name of the girl. Xenia on the top.
the ever so subtle naming nomenclature of the James Bond franchise.
Always. Judi Dench.
Which did become one of the best jokes in Mike Myers. Mike Myers' Austin Power films was the obvious. No entendres. Not a double entendre. Not a single entendre. A no entendre of their names.
Well, classic ones. You have Honey Rider. You have Pussy Galore.
Holly Goodnight.
Yeah, right? There's just so many good ones.
Merry Christmas.
Because
Denise...
Jones?
Christmas Jones, that's what it was. Denise Richards as a nuclear scientist. So believable.
Miranda Frost. Yes, with blonde hair. Mm-hmm. There's just some really good ones there.
True.
Judi Dench is M. Samantha Bond is Moneypenny. Alan Cumming, who's always fun.
Oh, yeah, that's right. As that
the
jittery tech guy with the pen.
Yeah.
That's a great sequence. I forgot about that until you just mentioned it.
There's one that I'm missing that is, oh yes, Robbie Coltrane as Valentin Dmitriev,
Dmitriev shows up a couple of times in the Brosnan era, doesn't he?
I think he comes back for World Is Not Enough, I think.
Yeah, I think that might be it. I'm not...
Didn't they blow up a building or something with his caviar in it?
Yes.
Zukovsky, that was his last name. Mm-hmm. But he's a lot of fun. This movie, yes, it feels dated, but the jokes are still there. The sexual wit is still there. Sean Bean really gets the point across that he is a Bond villain, and not in an overbearing way. Like, you can understand the pain between the two main characters, mm-hmm. and he doesn't go about explaining his plan like the traditional Bond villains. He just wants to get down to brass tacks, kill him, move on, be home in time for tea.
True.
But the action sequences are solid, and I can't say it enough.
It's a good watch.
It's a lot of fun.
It's a good watch. Okay.
And what about you?
Oh, well. Well, this past weekend at the Metrograph in New York City, they premiered a new restoration of Jackie Chan's classic breakout film, Police Story. And I was reading about the new transfer and everything that they were showing, and a lot of appreciations about Jackie Chan's work, especially his Hong Kong films. And it got me thinking, I call myself a Jackie Chan fan, but I haven't gone back and watched any of his Hong Kong work in several years now. I think for a lot of people here in the States, they know he's from Hong Kong. They might have seen a couple of his films, but they mainly know him for the Shanghai Noon films that he did with Owen Wilson, or the Rush Hour films that he did with Chris Tucker, or a lot of really bad American-produced action films like the Tuxedo.
The Medallion.
The Medallion. Yeah, there's just a pile.
Super Cop.
Nope, Super Cop was one of his Hong Kong films that the Weinstein Company purchased, redubbed, and kind of chopped down a little bit.
Well, that goes to show you just how much I know about Jackie Chan.
That's okay. I think, you know, a lot of people are like you, unfortunately, are
ouch.
just not that familiar with his Hong Kong work. So I went back and I rewatched Police Story. And man, what a great fun film. Sure, it is very stuck in the late 80s in terms of fashion and the synthesizer score and everything. Story-wise, it gets a little soggy there in the middle because Jackie is protecting a mobster's girlfriend who is in witness protection, basically. And he can't even tell his own girlfriend that he's doing this. So he's trying to protect this woman, this gorgeous woman, without his girlfriend finding out. And his girlfriend keeps seeing them out. And it becomes, you know, a bit of a comedy of errors there in the middle. But every action sequence from the beginning of the film, where they basically destroy a hillside village by driving cars through it, to the big climactic sequence, the chase through a mall, which ends with one of Jackie's most famous stunts where he slides down this pole filled with lights and, you know, just breaks every single light bulb on the way down as he's like sliding down this pole and in the process giving himself second degree burns.
Yeah.
It's just every action sequence, you see him throwing himself into it. The choices all feel very natural. It's not very staged. There's portions where he's fighting bad guys and he's just grabbing anything he can to throw at them. It's not like, oh, here's this thing that looks like a pair of nunchucks and I can use it as nunchucks. He's just grabbing books, whatever's, you know, a coffee mug, whatever he can throw, and then using found objects that would naturally occur in that space they're fighting, and then using it for a, you know, as a weapon or what have you. But at the same time, you can also see his Buster Keaton influences from the Silent Comedian. And sometimes he works that into the action sequences too. In the beginning, when he's chasing after the bad guys, they steal a double-decker bus. He's chasing after them on foot. He grabs an old lady's umbrella and jumps, hangs onto the side of the bus with
the umbrella?
By the umbrella, in exact way that Buster Keaton did it in an old short. And in fact, he actually lifts certain gags from Keaton as he's doing this, and it's just a delight. Jackie Chan still has this aesthetic of I am going to entertain the hell out of you, even if I have to hurt myself very badly to do so.
I just realized that both of our recommendations, the leads have worked together. Pierce and Jackie just did The Foreigner.
That's right.
Even realize that until we were talking.
Yeah, I didn't put that together either. I like that. But honestly, I'm not sure I would recommend The Foreigner.
Really?
It's to kind of divert away from both our topics, both our recommendations here.
I would say
The Foreigner is a good movie that doesn't need Jackie Chan in it at all. It could be just about Pierce Brosnan's character trying to find out the information he needs. Jackie's character is almost secondary to the plot, and if you pull him out of the plot, I think the movie still kind of holds together all on its own.
Okay.
So, again, that's another Jackie Chan role in a U.S. film that doesn't quite really work well. And it's a shame that, he got the big exposure here in the U.S. I think out of all of his Hollywood films, I like Shanghai Noon and Shanghai Nights the best. I think that uses him the best without being terrible.
Not Around the World in 80 Days?
Oh, good Lord, no. Ugh, that movie is a disaster. And on that note, we're going to wrap up this week's episode of the Big Picture Podcast. Thank you all for listening. Next week, we'll be back with more news analysis and a review of the latest upcoming video game adaption, Tomb Raider, with Alicia Vikander. I am of the opinion that there has never been a really good, solid video game adaptation. A couple films have come close, but one's never really kind of been a solid B-plus film. So will this one be the one to break out of that mold? We'll see.
So join us next time on the Big Picture Podcast.
What do you see?